Hi, this is Ross Payton here, and we're doing Unspeakable, Episode 5. And with me is Shane Ivey, Scott Glancy, and now and special guest Greg Stoles. And we're going to be talking about gaming, mythos gaming in various historical eras, from the modern to the ancient, and how to prepare and how to run these games. Of course, we also have news and updates on the goings-ons of Arc Dream and Pagan Publishing, and Mr. Stoles' efforts as well, so and some of mine.
Know it's Stoltzy, right?
Stolzy?
Yeah. Oh. Are you just screwing with him, wanting to keep
I was a little unsure about that. So
we're using his right name before we started recording, so I thought, clearly Ross has got some comedy shtick up his sleeve.
Oh, I'm sorry. My bad. Greg, from now on, you're Stolz.
Yeah, Stolzy.
Kind of like Eric.
Then they took my name away.
It's like Ellis Island. What's your name?
First your hope, then your
name. You're now Smith. Yeah.
We've given you a number and took away your name.
Welcome to Small Press Publishing.
Yes.
You are now number 6.
I would have said that this is the most humiliating thing that's ever happened to me, except that I've been a writer for too long.
You drew a paycheck from White Wolf. What are you talking about?
And will again.
I like paychecks.
Paychecks are nice.
I miss paychecks.
What do they look
like? Slag White Wolf too hard.
Yeah.
No, they pay on time. That's
they pay money.
Yeah.
You know.
They can afford to pay money sometimes. They're kings.
But first, Shane, you wanted to talk about the sponsors.
Yes. So I don't want to forget the sponsors. Because I'm horrible and lazy. We don't have a new issue of The Oath yet, which means we're still harping on the same guys that supported the last issue. So, you know, more free publicity for them. Good job on getting in on that. again, Miskatonic River Press. Legacy of Arius Lyrico is their last thing out that I've been talking about. They probably have like 2 new books already, but I've been too lazy to look them up. So my apologies there. But, Tom Lynch that runs the show there is awesome and longtime, friend and colleague and buddy. And, they've got, you know, basically all of this, you know, the sort of the core of, really good Cthulhu writers sort of make the same rounds between The Oath and Miskatonic and some of the Mythos monographs and even some of the official books when Chaosium does those from time to time. So check them out at miskatonicriverpress.com. Atlas Games, of course, as I've said many times, are amazing people and good friends and they do great stuff. So they're Ken Heitz children's Cthulhu-y children's books are hilarious, and Cthulhu Gloom.
I don't know if they're Cthulhu-y children's books. They're Cthulhu books. They're more children-y
Cthulhu books. Is that you think?
Yeah,
I think that's a good distinction. I actually had my kids got curious and read Clifford the Big Red God, and afterward they had that kind of confused and thoughtfully disturbed smile on their face as they were trying to process the ending. And so maybe don't let the young ones actually read them, just pretend that they're reading them. They're at atlas-games.com. And where was I? I think Innsmouth Free Press I was talking about next. That they did historical Lovecraft, and they're another one that, you know, they apparently have actual, you know, schedules and deadlines that they care about. So they've got all kinds of new stuff on their website and in their catalog at InnsmouthFreePress.com. H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, HPL Film Festival. Let's try that again. HPLfilmfestival.com. And their next show is in May in Portland. So you folks in the Northwest, go to that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do it.
Not a suggestion.
Yeah.
Consider the other film festival, which is part of this franchise, is down in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Pretty much you guys on the East Coast are screwed. Yes. Anyone who's like, you know, taking some time to move to Providence and live down the street from Lovecraft's old family home, you're screwed. We've set this up so that now you have to cross the entire continent. And it's going to be well worth it.
We won't even speak of those who live in flyover country, i.e. the rest of the country.
Hey!
I'm in there, too, so
Chicago's not flyover. Now, Shane, you're in flyover.
Well, I'm in Alabama. I don't have to fly anywhere to see unspeakable horrors.
Yeah, the wife is in law enforcement.
Yeah.
So, moving right along.
Yeah, moving right along, we have a bunch of news and updates. I know, Shane, you wanted to talk about Delta Green's Strange Authorities and the unspeakable status on Delta Green's.
Oh, yeah. Well, Strange Authorities, not a huge amount new. We had planned on having that out already, but John's been tinkering, and he's actually working on a small little bonus thing to put in there for the fans who've
it is all to the fans' benefit.
Yeah. But since John apparently has a day job that involves him flying in airplanes all the time, from what I can tell from his Facebook statuses, it's he's sort of got a
he doesn't actually work out
when he has free moments and to dig into it. So, but I'm okay with with putting the thing off for a little while to let that happen. Let's see what else. Oath 21. No real news. It's entirely my fault for basically my sort of work schedule on Arc Dream stuff tends to be I'll have a few weeks at a time where I work like a fiend and do nothing else in life, and then get totally exhausted and burnt out and accomplish like nothing for weeks at a time, and it's really dysfunctional and weird. But you know, in lieu of it being a steady job, that's kind of how it has to happen. So Oath 21 is still sort of puttering along, and I've got great. You know, it's everybody else has done excellent work. Greg's done great work for it, and Tynes has done great work helping with the editing, and Dan Harms, and we've got some great material, and it all just hinges on me getting my shit together. So we'll see.
No. I haven't finished my assignment either. So let's go ahead and leap under the bus there.
I totally forgot, Scott. You're working on the new column. Right.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. Do you have your topic squared away on that already?
Yes, he says, lying through his teeth. Absolutely have my topic squared away.
So next episode, I'll have somebody new to blame for Oath 21 not being out.
Exactly.
Yay!
It's all about shifting the blame.
It's almost like progress, but
almost like it.
I'm a little narcissistic and curious. Which of the stuff I sent in is going into 21? It can't be Star Chamber. I know you guys haven't had time to test that, but the reviews.
Certainly the reviews, and then and then I think maybe Die High. I think that's actually pretty pretty clean as is, but I'll take a look. No promises yet.
One of those reviews, I don't want to give anything away, but I really do think that I found the perfect book for 1920s, 1930s Call of Cthulhu. So,
very good.
And then, what else? The Delta Green RPG that project, sort of the big main outline of how it's all going to come together in front of the three Delta Green guys, and to make sure that it's not totally offensive and egregious to their sensibilities. And so once
what was the comment on RPGNet predicting that they'd take out everything that was creepy and just make it a big shotgun fest?
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, somebody, that's what somebody hypothesized.
Predicted.
Right, right. So so we'll see.
You're just going to get it back, and on every page, more shotguns.
Right, right. What's with this emo bullshit?
Feelings? What are those? Can I shotgun them?
Yeah. How many experience points do I get for crushing my feelings?
So, I've had Kenneth Height kind of on the line for since the beginning of this project when we were planning it to help contribute to it. So I'm going to get him and Greg to take over the rules development and tightening up and you know, and everything, as well as
putting in the shotguns, yeah. Making sure the apostrophes are in the right place.
Yeah. Well, the apostrophes I don't care so much. Well, I do, but I'll take care of that. But you know, where I feel like your expertise is going to serve everybody best is on actually the heavy lifting of writing the rules and you know, I'll get help to make sure that the copy is relatively clean.
Damn it, I got into this whole writing thing to avoid heavy lifting. Have you seen my hands? They are incredibly delicate. There's not a callus to be foul of them. You can tell I've never done a hard day's labor in my life.
I've seen Stolte's hands. They look like they're made out of baby butts.
Well, luckily it was metaphorical heavy lifting, so we'll, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me,
Scott.
Enjoy it. It's the last time you're ever going to hear anything that nice.
So, Scott, what's happening with Bumps in the Night?
Well, actually, Shane, you wanted to mention the final report recording, or to talk a little bit about that.
Well, we'll put that in the feed here a little bit later, but it's fun. John Scott Tynes sent an audio file that his father recorded. His father, having retired as a radio announcer a few years back, and his dad recorded an audio of him doing a reading of the story Final Report, which is the infamous Reginald Fairfield email that John wrote back in the early 90s as sort of an early teaser for what the Delta Green source book was going to
had to be close to 96.
I think it was even earlier than that. I remember reading it in on AOL, on America Online, before you know, we had these things like websites.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I'd get on to PC Link.
Like staring at a cave wall and trying to figure out which was a buffalo and which was a stick figure.
Right. Yeah. So I'm going to have a little teaser excerpt of that here, and then we'll have the whole thing for people to enjoy probably next episode.
Great. So about that Bumps in the Night.
All right. So where were we? All right. So
the Kickstarter approved it.
Yeah. The news on Bumps in the Night is that Kickstarter finally approved our fundraising proposal. And now it is up to me to cobble together a video to promote the item, fundraising the print budget for Bumps in the Night. At this stage, Mr. Payton and Mr. Stolze here were very helpful and made some suggestions before we started recording about some things that could be done in that department. So hopefully that'll be up in the next week or so. The other thing that's on the table is that for a couple weeks now, the nice folks at Drive-Thru RPG have had all of our out-of-print Delta Green books. Alien Intelligence, Dark Theaters, Countdown, and the original Nod D20 version of Delta Green. And they are tearing the books into little tiny pieces and feeding them into a scanner. And we'll have some copies of Delta Green ready to go for sale that way very soon. And Arc Dream has already got Eyes Only and Targets of Opportunity as PDFs ready to go. And they will be heading out now. the reason we're going this route is because the old books were all laid out in ancient PageMaker 4 files from a million years ago. And yeah, we just the work of trying to go through and take out all the D20 material or convert the PageMaker files to InDesign files has been so long, laborious, and fraught with delays that we finally just surrendered and said, screw it, we're going to send the books off to drive through. They're going to destroy them, scan them in, and what we will have happen is, and certainly this is what drive through promised me, is that once we finally get the layout-produced PDF files, which I presume will be searchable, unlike the scanned ones, mm-hmm. Once we get those in, they will substitute the files, and anyone who's previously purchased the PDF through drive-through can get an updated version for free. Mm-hmm. They'll get the better version a little bit. They can get the better version later. Won't cost them a thing. You don't get penalized because you bought early rather than waiting for the version you wanted to show up at all. It'll all show up. It'll be free. So with any luck, that'll be going live in maybe less than a month, maybe sometime in February. Mm-hmm. So finally, Countdown will be available, and it will also be available as print-on-demand. However, I haven't calculated the cost of Countdown as a POD through drive-through, but at 424 pages, including a fold-out map, which we may not include because the map appears also in Eyes Only and is. Well, very nice.
And also, their POD service is not going to be able to print a fold-out map and bind it into the book.
So at 424 pages, a book that was priced at $44.95 in 2000 or 99, it's going to be expensive. So
there was a fold-out map in that? Mine didn't have a fold-out map in it.
Well,
neither will any of the new ones, so you're in luck.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like you have a modern version.
Everything really was better in the past.
So it's so hot.
Yeah,
it will be expensive. I mean, this is a huge book, but at least it won't be the price of $400 that people are asking on eBay for a copy of Countdown. But
bear in mind, folks, when the price tag is $200, that's half off. Yeah.
So the chances are is that it'll probably be at minimum of 50, probably somewhere under 75, I hope. But the POD will be pretty expensive. But at least it'll be available should you care to burn one off.
That's great news because I know I've wanted Countdown to be in print to show my friends or to have my friends some way of buying it at some point because the Haster Mythos section alone was just worth getting for me. I bought it for $60 used a couple of years ago, and just that alone, I've run several games based on those Carcosa Haster Mythos. So I've been wanting to show it to my friends. Like, this section is great. This is why I did the Night Mall game. This is why I did all these other games. And,
but you can't touch it.
Yeah, you can't touch it. You can't read it, and I can't show you it. Yeah.
Well, and
by the way, speaking of the Haster Mythos, first of all, Haster. Anyway, first of all, it's Haster. Second of all, who caught the Hotel Carcosa? Because was it the Hotel Carcosa?
Yeah, Hotel Carcosa. It was on the Delta Green. Or no, who did post
somebody
that?
Found it on the Delta Green mailing list and sent it in, and I had sent them an email directly saying, well, you need to get this to Tynes. And then it got to Tynes, and then it got to a friend of Tynes who just happened to be in Malaysia at the time who went and visited the place.
Oh, wow.
There's a Hotel Carcosa?
Yeah, we'll put a link up in there. Yeah, it was the Rook on the Delta Green email list on January 14th that just pulled up the message. It was somebody who was a fan of the original stories, the Carcosa stories, and
but early on, I mean, this was it was originally built like at the turn of the 20th century, Chambers was still kicking and his stories were really new. And this is a guy that he was basically a as what as if I can tell, he was a British functionary or sort of mercantile guy who just really loved those stories, as well he should have. And
he was like, he was some colonial official. I want to say, was it the governor's house or the governor's residence?
It became like sort of the colonial governor's residence for a long time. And then when that stopped, they made it a hotel.
Later renamed King's House.
Yeah. The website, the best website for it is Malaysian-explorer.com / Carcosa.html.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Someone has actually gone and touched the side of this physical, tangible building.
You can still stay there. It's still an active hotel.
Their website said that it was going to be shut down, but I hadn't seen any updates. I guess it's still active because there are like hotel, TripAdvisor reviews and stuff on it.
And if you can't make a scenario out of that, you're clearly not trying.
It belongs to the Malaysian government. Wow.
It's pretty sand wild. Check.
The more you know.
That's a beautiful photo of it.
It is. And so we'll have a link in the show notes. So those of you who didn't write it down, we'll have the URL so you can click and see. Plan your next trip to Malaysia and see if you can visit it before it is sold or disappeared or whatever happens. Right.
Fades away.
Yeah. Exactly.
You can go in it vanishing out of all sane reality.
Exactly. I want to talk about a few things that I'm working on right now. I'm working on a follow-up novel to Zombies of the World, but I've also written sort of a short story called Zombies in Afghanistan. It's and I'm going to be releasing that as a 99-cent ebook on Kindle and Smashwords and all the other ebook websites. And it's about what happens when zombies show up in Afghanistan and bad things happen.
Afghanistan meaning in the middle of the war.
Yeah, yeah. American soldiers, Taliban, and zombies. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
So look forward to that. And then I'm also working on videos for the RPVR podcast. I'm trying to figure out a way to convert entire episodes so you can put them on YouTube as well, because you can upload hour-long videos now on YouTube. So for those of you who don't want to download an MP3, you'll be able to stream that eventually. And Scott sent me the notes for Divine Fire Libya, the PAX game, so I'll be able to edit that down into a six-hour game. I haven't finish the notes yet, so we'll be able to see what happens when Tom Church's idea goes from World War II to the modern day Libya, and I'm sure that was just a game of sunshine and happiness, right?
Well, I will point out that there was a fair chunk of sand loss. People are actually getting to the point where they're going, what's 20% of my sanity again? Has an hour gone by? Well, they said I'd have to worry about that rule, which, doesn't often come up. But, there was a lot of the last 30 minutes, 40 minutes of the game, it's pretty much right on the edge of a player character firefight the whole time. As the players are all set to start shooting each other over arguing over the morality of the only solution that was laid before them. It worked out really well.
That's awesome.
So we'll have that up on RPPR soon. And Scott, I could be looking at Greg's name right in the middle of the conference call thing. Scott, you had a game you recorded part of for Gen Con. Do you want to put that up for the next Unspeakable? I think I have the download of it. I think you uploaded it to me, so I could edit that as well.
Oh, you're talking about... I'm not sure which one it was.
The Dead Man Stomp, or not that.
The Vengeful Dead. That is actually... The problem with that game is, and I don't think I need to put that one forward, is that when I made up pre-generated characters for it, I made the pre-generated characters far too interesting. And the result was I got this group of guys and a girl, Lisa Paddle, who's the only person I can remember on that because she used to write for The Oath. But they ended up having a game that I didn't need to be there. They just started making their own fun, you know, which was hilarious and entertaining. But at the same time, it's like that whole dead part of the Vengeful Dead, we never got to that. You know,
they at least vengeful?
Here's the deal. It's a scenario where it says in the text, you know, if there's a woman who's going to do a tarot reading the day before the bad shit happens, and when she does, the tarot reading goes all kawampy and she just throws the cards down, is very disturbed, goes to her room and won't pick them up again, you know. Everyone's supposed to, you know, that's your foreshadowing. My players on their own found a way to hold a seance, a fake seance, to convince some punch drunk boxer that it was not his fault that he killed a guy in the ring, so they can get him back into training and get him back, you know, into the boxing circuit. And I thought, well, shit, if they're going to hold a seance, then all kinds of crazy bullshit should happen. You know, I had no idea it was going to go that way. I thought they were just going to pass the evening and then the next morning, you know, some shit would happen. They just generated this all on their own. It completely went off the rails, and then ultimately ended with two characters in the hotel who knew each other and were, you know, and, you know, sort of, there's a bag woman for the mob and a treasury agent who's following her and following the money, and she's stealing the money and she thinks he's a gangster trying to kill her. So they kind of stumble to each other's presence, flee the hotel in the middle of the night, and steal all the vehicles at the hotel to make their escape, thereby marooning all the other players at the hotel for the horrible shit that's about to happen. That was great. I mean, I love the fact that, you know, through no prompting of my own, all of the escape routes were closed.
Wow, you guys went to town on each other a lot sooner than I'd planned.
But I'm like, well, you guys are out of the scenario, so congratulations. You're all having a car chase. There's banjos playing. Now let's go to the people who were left behind in the hotel. And sadly, you know, it just got to the point where, you know, our table was booked for 4 hours and, you know, they needed to move on because we had new people coming in. But I don't know if we should really post it. It's kind of a fragment, right? You know?
Well, why don't we have the listeners comment and see if they want to listen to it or not? We can have them if you're listening to this and you want to hear the shenanigans of the Vengeful Dead, post a comment on the website on the Unspeakable Oath, and you know, Scott and I will see that, so we can
shenanigans.
Yes,
of the Vengeful Dead.
If you want to hear the shenanigans of the dead, yes, we'll. Or the shenanigans of the living prior to the dead showing up. Yes, we'll be more than happy to set you up with that.
Yeah. And then, Greg, Mr. Stolze, what
you got it right that time?
Yes. What do you have? What are you working on now? You said.
Well, what I'm working on, I'm always trying to, you know, promote my stuff, and I'm, you know, I think I'm a better writer than I am a self promoter, because. Mm. You know, I just kind of get lazy about it. But actually, the project that's most relevant to, you know, our topic for today, which is Mythos Through History, is, you know, Mask of the Other, my most recent novel, which someone described as being the Shadow over Innsmouth crossed with Black Hawk Down. And it is in many ways, you know, it's certainly a recent historical novel, but it's historical. There's parts that are set in the 80s to, you know, establish conflicts that get resolved in like 2008. But yeah, so I'm pushing that, and I will give you a link where people can buy it as a incredibly inexpensive $5 ebook, or you can get the bound Dead Tree version. Again, it's one of those print on demands we've been discussing. So it's about $17 to get the physical item. But yeah, so that's something I've done.
Yeah, I'm about I don't know, I think maybe halfway through it, and it's a very fun read. I'm having a great time.
Thank you for that vote of confidence. So yes, it's the premise is that a group of soldiers from the first Iraq war stumble across the wreckage of Saddam's terribly underfunded occult weaponry program and sort of loot it. And then it's one of these fun, oh, well, surely this Mythos device can solve all our problems.
Well, that's clearly what we love to do these days with the Mythos is they're not coming to, you know, the Mythos doesn't have to have a big giant plan to come get humanity and eat us and use us as hors d'oeuvres. All you have to do is dangle a little advantage in front of the monkeys and they'll be more than happy to flush the planet down the toilet.
Metaphorically, this is like, you know, these guys are sticking their heads in H.H. Holmes' murder castle going, what's going on in here?
Hey, guys, do you guys have
ding, 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 service? So, yes, it's, you know, soldiers, Mythos, Deep Ones, and other stuff. And so, yeah, you can get a preview from that on my website and stuff. But other stuff that I've been working on has been for, I've been, the other Mythos things I've been working on are a couple adventures for the Oath and a introductory adventure for the new version of Delta Green called Wormwood Arena. So how much am I allowed to talk about these, Shane?
Oh, let's go ahead and say what's the idea behind Wormwood Arena and sort of what did you find compelling about the idea behind it as you were dreaming it up?
What Wormwood Arena is and this actually arose from the talk we had at Gen Con this year where we were all sitting around talking about having the forum with the public about how with the Oath you constantly have to be shifting and doing something new and finding a new wrinkle on things, and that this is far more important for horror gaming than it is for, say, fantasy or adventure or space opera. Mm-hmm. That to startle and appall, you have to always have a new ingredient in. And so the new ingredient I wanted to put in Wormwood Arena was undercover. That I want to, this is how you run a game where some of the characters are undercover trying to infiltrate an actual cult. Mm-hmm. And the cult I set up for Wormwood Arena is, again, one of these kind of not global, it's acting locally, not globally, but it's fairly weak because, you know, I'm like, we probably don't want an introductory scenario that most likely outcome is TPK. We want something that's survivable. So,
and that's where Greg differs from Dennis Detweiler in his scenario planning, because Dennis doesn't even that consideration is never considered.
It's a whole philosophical distinction. Do you pursue the total party? I don't know. Dennis's approach seems to be total party mockery to me. I envision him as he's writing these things, kind of occasionally chortling and rubbing his hands together in evil glee.
Well, we all do that.
I've seen him write. It's more of a snort of derision. It's more of a
fuck those guys.
And the gate's radioactive. And if they get past the radioactive gate, then there's dinosaurs.
So yeah, Wormwood Arena. The thing I wanted to add in was going undercover, and I've got another Delta Green scenario that I've pitched to the Oath called Star Chamber, which is one of those ideas where you're like, okay, this will either be really nifty or we'll find that I've withdrawn the essential ingredient of the horror game. The premise for Star Chamber is that it's all a flashback, that your regular characters, for once, are not going to be in danger of their lives or sanity. They've been asked to, well, they've been sort of assigned to serve as judge and jury on another cell that has become horribly dysfunctional after a giant screw up in Burma. And so you get the Rashomon scenes. You actually play through different versions of what happened in the past on this disastrous operation. And on one hand, the players go in there going, oh, well, I know my character survives. I have plot immunity. And, you know, on the other, so I just have to concentrate on making a jerk out of my rival, right? But on the other hand, you know, everything they say determines their future. In the game's present. So it was a little bit inspired, actually, by the Blair Reynolds story from the first Delta Green fiction anthology. What was that one called?
Looking Glass.
Yeah. And I liked the narrative framework there, where you've got the courtroom in the present that sets up all this, foreshadowing of how the operation went bad and how so few people survived. And then you go back and get, you know, the meat grinder they went through. And I wanted to see if I could recreate the Looking Glass kind of feel, and have it be, you know, something playable and interesting. And, you know, I think it'll be a nice change of pace for people where it's like, oh, hey, I can play with these toys and it doesn't matter if I break the arms off.
Yeah,
I still think you need to. Your players still need to walk out of that with a sand loss of some ilk, some nice erosion of 1, 2, 3 points, just because they've gotten to sit there and hear the bad story, you know.
Well,
know that it could just have easily have been them.
Yeah,
not these pre-gens.
Well, if the only thing that's off the table is your character dies, you know, that still leaves a lot of room for horrible, horrible things to imagine.
Bingo.
Oh, well, and they're in there. I mean, what you know that one character dies. So, you know, if you get stuck with that guy, you're like, well, okay, that's the end of me in sometime in the next 48 hours. And another character, it's established, is just completely mentally gone. And so there are three left who are physically whole and comparatively sane. And each of them has a completely different version of what happened in Burma. And, you know, one of them is, you know, it was straight up good versus evil. And these guys were, you know, cowards and couldn't get it over the goal line, and they're failures. And then another guy's presentation is, no, it was a very difficult, murky situation. There was a lot going on that was unclear. This guy jumped the gun, shot up a bunch of people who could have been our allies, and that's why we weren't able to complete the mission. And then there's the third guy who's just like, both these guys seemed to be doing pretty well in a situation with a lot of pressure and limited information, and I don't necessarily know that the situation got resolved one way or the other, but we sure as hell can't go back now.
Yeah, that sounds like how the operation should turn out.
So that's Star Chamber. But, you know, it could wind up completely different after playtesting. There's a great bit in 3 Days to Now. Can I digress for a minute?
Sure.
What else are we here for?
There's a great bit in the Tim Powers novel, 3 Days to Never, where this guy has intuitions about the last time he's going to perform an action. Like, this is the last time I'm going to come to Los Angeles. He just knows this for a fact. And as the book goes on, the things he knows he's doing for the last time get more and more every day. And it's like, this is the last time I'm going to pat a cat. This is the last time I'm going to ring a doorbell. This is the last time I'm going to hear a telephone. And so, you know, from the beginning, this guy's doomed. He's going to die over the course of the book, but it's still very, very tense, even with that inevitability. So we'll see if I can make that work.
All right.
Well, so you lazy fucker, way to set the bar way down there, huh? Holy shit, Greg.
Well, I think...
always got to stay on.
Yeah, exactly. I think this at this point we'll have a brief interlude so we can have an excerpt from the final report read by Alan Tynes, and then we'll get into the main topic, gaming, Mythos gaming in various eras, past, present, and future. So we'll be back in a second.
All right.
Evil never dies. Darkness never retreats. In the cracks and the crevices of our society, there are monsters undreamed of by the rank and file of humanity. I've been there. I've seen them. They exist in the spaces between things, in the folds of existence where we can't find them. Sometimes they cross over. Sometimes they manifest, and all hell breaks loose. Only this is not hell, nor heaven. This is like nothing anyone has ever understood. This is pure evil, pure destruction. This is the apocalypse. I've been fighting it tooth and nail since 1961. They made me retire in 1970 when Cambodia blew up in their faces and they blamed us. But I didn't stop then and I'm not stopping now. They think I gave it all up that day in the Pentagon when they told me the choice, the only choice I'd be allowed. I took it. And then, like most of us, I made the decision to continue the fight. They thought we were washed up. They know nothing. But they know enough.
And we are back, and we're going to be talking about gaming in various eras, past, present, and future. It's a very appropriate topic because I recently ran a Call of Cthulhu game set in 1952 Japan, Hiroshima, basing it slightly on the film series Battles Without Honor or Humanity, where I had the players as Yakuza members fighting elements of the Cthulhu mythos. I used some elements from the book Secrets of Japan, Taoist alchemy, and the Yakuza boss wanted to become immortal, and you know, bad things started to happen. So, but when I was running it,
nothing wrong with that plan.
Yeah. When I was running it, I ran into some problems because I had done research on, you know, the Yakuza, and I was familiar with how they were organized. And but I realized halfway through the game that I didn't really look into the relationship of, like, or some of the nuts and bolts stuff of the era, which is like who that was still the occupation period. So what was the exact relationship between the local Japanese government and the Americans? Like, you know, did the military police control everything in there?
Let me ask a question there, sir. When you picked the time period, you picked the place because you wanted Yakuza. When you picked the time period, what was your goal in picking that particular time period?
Well, I wanted Yakuza. I wanted one. The films themselves were like excellent. I wanted to emulate some of that, and I didn't want to set it in the modern era because I didn't want to. I wanted it to be very a local game, you know, in one city, one era, not have to worry about, you know, the international repercussions of globalized crime today, and to a lesser degree, cell phones and other things that connect people. So I just wanted to keep it relatively simple but modern, if that makes sense.
Okay, all right.
So there were some issues that I wish I had done more research on, like
or slid the game a few years one way or the other.
Yeah,
if you'd slid the game a few years further down the line into the 60s,
you could have
avoided that.
Well, I wanted it in the early 50s too because I still wanted the black market to be very dominant in the sense that, you know, that was the main economic engine of Japan immediately after the war. That's how the Yakuza became so powerful, because they fueled all the black markets.
Yeah. Okay.
That was so running a historical game is still a very challenging thing because I didn't really anticipate the players going in certain directions, so I wasn't quite as prepared with, like, who would show up if there was a large gunfight at a school, you know, playground.
right.
You know,
well, would it be I think, you know, the research is something that's going to be a hurdle no matter what era. I mean, even if you slide it 10 years to the early 60s, you're still going to have to do your reading to figure out what the culture was like, you know, and what and like Ross says, what are the nuts and bolts? You know, if you're running a game, especially, I mean, you know, if you're writing a story, it's pretty easy because if you don't want to talk about a certain subject, you just don't talk about it. You know, you skirt around it. That's not what your story's about.
But in a game, the players won't give you that option.
Yeah, in a game, you've got to be really well prepared to at least, give a cursory answer to a lot of different things that they might jump into, you know. And so
and players know. I mean, players can just home in on the one corner of the environment that you actually know nothing about.
Right. You know, and yeah. And sometimes they'll give you a break when they realize that, and other times they'll just think it's funny as fuck to get in on the thing that you weren't prepared for.
One of the, the approach. I'm not very good at remembering historical details, and I'm not the historian that the other mythos writer we all talk about who lives in the area is. But I kind of tend to approach it with the joke about the guy, the two campers who come across the bear and start to put yes, his shoes on.
Except
I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to know everything about 1960s Japan. You just have to know more than your players.
Well, I guess that's what I was getting at when I said cover it in a cursory manner, because the research you need to do, I feel like you need to do just enough that you can say a line. You know, you can give a snippet that'll convey some sense. And then, God forbid you have a player who's more of an expert, than you are, because then, that puts the player in the position of either just smiling and going along with all your mistakes or being a dick, And
I'm not sure those are the only two options, though. I think it is possible if you find out that, this player knows more. Okay, for example, I remember as a very simple example, I was, running a game and had a boa constrictor drop out of the trees on one of the characters. And, I'm describing the combat and immediately, the woman who had been snake dropped is like, oh, no, they don't attack like that.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess that's the other thing. You get them involved. Like, what they'll do is they'll bite and then they'll wrap around the bite site so you can't pry their head off. And I'm like, this is kind of awesome.
Right. And that's when the other players are like, dude, why'd you tell him that? That's even worse.
I think it was her own player or her own character getting attacked. Mm-hmm. And so what I think you need to do is to not reject because it's a positive thing that they care enough about what's right to say, oh, well, you got this detail wrong. They were not in fact wearing sneakers back in 1950s Japan. If you can get that expert inside the tent pissing out instead of outside the tent pissing in, it's much better for everyone involved. The expert gets to be cool, gets to say, no, well, here's what things were like in 1950s Japan. You get to have your game improved by the input of an expert, and everybody gets, the advantage of there not being the GM and the player engaging in this, power struggle of who knows who's got the deeper knowledge of this place and time. And, that can take a little finesse. But I think when you get it, it really, it's kind of a neat
That's a very good jiu-jitsu. Point.
I've certainly done the same thing in games where somebody turned up with some, specialized information that, you just incorporated it. You just went ahead and went, okay. And you incorporated what they had and it wasn't throwing the game off. It wasn't, and it was usually things, the kind of things I'm imagining, here I'm pressed to come up with a specific example, but I was able to just, like Greg did, it's like, okay, we'll incorporate your, specialized knowledge into this situation and we'll defer to that, whatever it was. Maybe it was, something about automobiles in the 20s or aircraft or something like that. And we just moved on. The trick is to me, is when that is, it's when you've hung the plot on a point. All I can think of is when you're going to do that, if you're going to hang the plot point on a piece of technology, you better goddamn better do your research. And for crying out loud, It's the age of Google and Wikipedia. Those two sources will give you great starting points. You know, I mean, I can, when I was doing the original research for Delta Green, you know, I'm down in the University of Florida's library, you know, stumbling around trying to find all my information. You know, nowadays I could have done it in, you know, a quarter of the time, maybe less.
The research, they're getting the players involved. That's a very good point. And I guess, I don't know, maybe the reason I didn't key in on it is because I'm thinking of horror games, but all of the, I mean, I do historical games all the time and with historians and it's usually, it's actually really good in those games because, we're all kind of on the same page, you know? And so when we're doing our Aces and Eights Wild West game, you know, with guys who are Western aficionados, you know, they can sort of plug in a little detail. If I get something wrong, they can mention it and, you know, and I like the correction in that case, cause I think it's interesting and I like learning a new fact, you know,
it doesn't become a big thing.
Yeah. And you know, and then I can sort of say, oh, okay, well that's cool. So I'll sort of tweak what I was talking about to make it right, you know? And then by the same token, when we were running our big Napoleonics role-playing game a year or two ago, you know, it was the same sort of thing where, you know, I did my homework as best I could, but, you know, there were still details I didn't know about. And if one of the guys did, then we sort of folded it in. With horror, it's a little trickier because so much, it depends on mystery because it depends on surprise, even more than other role-playing games where it depends on mystery because you want suspense. You know, you want the players to be kind of guessing at what's important and what's, you know, nothing, everything could be trivial or could be critical. And my instinct is that makes it trickier with horror games, but I don't know if there's anything you can do about that. You know, I mean, if it's a historical game, you're still going to want to kind of do your reading, especially on a key plot point. And and if the player knows more than you do, you know, be willing to let the player chime in and correct, you know, add details, because more details in historical games mean more immersion, more verisimilitude, and that's what you want. I think what I was thinking was that you're, you know, one way you can sort of get around this is by making sure that your key plot points don't hinge on that kind of a detail, you know, but hinge on personality, you know, hinge on things that don't depend on the era as much.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the two, if you dig down to the very most oversimplified basics, GMing consists of asking questions and making descriptions and some die rolling. And, you know, I think some GMs, especially if you've done a ton of research and have a really super prepared scenario with, you know, all the awesome props and everything, is that you tend to forget just how useful it can be to ask them a question. It's like, well, why haven't the allied MPs showed up? Well, gee, that's a very good question. Why do you suppose that might be that the allied MPs haven't showed up when you're shooting up this school? What could have prevented them? And now, instead of breaking the sense of reality, you have characters behaving very appropriately, which is getting paranoid and saying, well, the authorities are clearly in on it, or the authorities are clearly in check. And to boil that down, sometimes if you don't know the answer, just ask the question. And if nothing else, the players will all start arguing about which answer is correct, and you'll be able to drop your ninja smoke bomb and disappear.
Yeah. However, I would point out that sometimes this can lead to a situation where if you do not explain things in a historical context to your players, you could conceivably lead to misunderstandings and assumptions that aren't true. What I'm thinking of is situations where people perhaps, and again, this is probably this is might be a problem for younger players, or less experienced players, where they make assumptions about things like, oh, I don't know, police response time, or speed of travel, things like that that may not be appropriate for that time period. You know, police competence, for instance. And I want to talk a little bit more about that a little bit later when it comes to, you know, your different time periods. But, you know, I can think of a couple situations where people presume something about travel time based on sort of modern expectations. And it led to it led to players shooting other players. because they were convinced.
And this troubles you, why?
Well, you know, because it didn't need to happen, and it wasn't my game. You know,
want the players to be you know, frightened, but you don't want them to feel frustrated and cheated. You know, and I think with the historical game, I always wind up trying to at the beginning of the game, sort of laying down the ground rules. You know, of saying, you know, here's sort of a summary of what life is like. You know, and hitting the highlights of travel, transportation, information. You know, here are the limitations. You know, or if it's a game where, you know, social stuff, social class matters a lot. You know, here are the rules that you're expected to follow, and the repercussions if you don't. You know, and that
if you spend 10 minutes alone with this unmarried woman, her reputation will be ruined forever unless she's a chambermaid.
Yeah. And that's something that I always wind up trying to do. I mean, my challenge personally is reining that in so that I don't spend an hour, you know, giving them an info dump of trivia that I find fascinating as a history geek, but other people might be their eyes glazing.
Yeah, there's a fine line between those two.
I completely blew that on my first time I ran. Last flight of the L-58, and sadly, Shane Ivey had to wade through that game where you fell to your death. I keep forgetting that was I met Ross and I killed it.
Who among us has not considered doing the same?
But the giant flaw was that I didn't want to put the players in a situation where they'd want the Zeppelin to be able to do something. You know, or they'd come up with a brilliant plan, you know, to stop the monster. And I'd have to explain to them, this is not how a Zeppelin works. This is not how the technology works. You know, they're like, oh my God, we can't fire a gun in the Zeppelin or we'll blow ourselves to pieces. And I have to explain, it doesn't quite work that way. Or maybe they have other preconceptions. The problem is that explaining at the beginning, nobody remembered it when it came up later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even over a four-hour game session, when they come up with the brilliant plan, like, we'll land the Zeppelin and get off. I'm like, they don't land. You know, they crash. You'll be crashing the Zeppelin and maybe getting off. You know, then I would explain the downside to the plan based on, you know, what the problems of this aircraft's technology was, you know, rather than trying to do the info dump, which was just unsuccessful. That really didn't work at all. Yeah. Going ahead and just going, okay, well, we're going to walk into this club, and rather than try and explain early on, if you have a London game set, you know, between the wars or something, and maybe it involves as part of its, you know, primary fulcrum access to the upper class, you know, and the players want to get in somewhere, or rather than trying to explain all that at the beginning, I think you're better off just doling out these interesting tidbits. No, you're not going to get into the Travelers Club. You know?
Sorry, it's like Mordor. You don't just walk in.
But, you know, I think it's better to drop those kind of things and those
when it's appropriate. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like the balance to strike is getting everybody kind of on the same page in the broad strokes at the beginning, and then so that when you need to give a correction in the middle of things, it'll have some context. You know, it'll make sense. It'll be you sort of confirming something that you've already discussed with them. But that requires, when you give them those broad strokes at the beginning, making it short enough that they can digest it and remember it.
Right.
It doesn't just, you know, completely, you know, lead to them looking around until you get to the good stuff.
Yeah. Let's kind of move on towards one of the ideas I wanted to cover, which was, all right, how do we adapt? How do we take advantage of different time periods or even different, you know, locales in those time periods? How do we take advantage of those to continue to horrify mm-hmm. our players and give them a hard time?
I think
one thing.
Because I was going to say that the thing I always drives me up the wall to hear is whenever people talk about modern Call of Cthulhu or Delta Green, it's what's the big problem? I've got an Uzi now. The game's too easy because I have an Uzi and a cell phone and I have instant access to the internet. So I have all the Mythos tomes on my fucking, you know, iPad. I'm like, that's an advantage. I mean, how is that an advantage?
That's the thing. That's the thing to convey is you know, more information is not a good thing in this game. You know, I mean, if you're playing a modern day game and it's a spy thriller, the more information you have access to, the better. You know, yeah. And so your assumption is having access to the internet, and not only the internet, but the secret password into the giant, you know, NSA databases and whatnot. All that stuff is vital and necessary, and everybody knows instinctively. You know, I mean Osama bin Laden, you know, stayed alive for 10 years because nobody had the right information at the right time. Or when they did have the information, they couldn't act on it for political reasons. But, you know, and that's the thing, is you need to make having access to that information not only less effective than you might assume, but positively detrimental in some cases.
Well, I mean, yeah, I can always think of a reason to control the flow of information. Look at this podcast. We have had, you know, one fourth of the people involved has been having, you know, problems getting his signal breaking up.
Are you ever going to let that go, Stolte? You're never going to let that go.
Never. I mean, you can make people rely on their cell phones, and then, you know, have you ever had the battery die on your cell phone? Have you ever had your cell phone stop working for some reason that never gets explained? Have you ever had a signal drop because you go underground? Yeah. There's all kinds of ways to break that flow of information. But even if the flow of information is steady, there's still all kinds of problems. Yes, you can type something into Google and find this gigantic slew of information. And you know what? Now the problem is not that you have... that you can't get the signal at all. The problem is the signal to noise.
Oh yeah, and today, I mean, that's an issue that faces the real life intelligence agencies and has for the past 10 years is not necessarily getting information, but finding the right information. You know, the NSA provides the CIA and the White House with more data than they will ever be able to sift through, and they just, even the NSA doesn't have the technology that's sophisticated enough to search through for, you know, keywords in a way that makes it useful, you know. So
it becomes a kind of paralysis that they, you know, that there's all this information, but it remains totally and completely meaningless. And certainly the idea that the players are going to get on the internet
right.
in a modern game and find out about, you know,
the Mythos. Colton.
Yeah, they're going to be able to find the liner notes on what Unas Pritlik and Colton is. They're not going to find a copy.
Well,
they're not,
and they ought to be finding conflicting liner notes too, because these are
things exactly
half the shit that's put online about the Mythos tome that you want to research is done by posers who've never actually seen it.
Right. You know, exactly. The other 90... We had like the real Necronomicons in bookstores today, written by, you know, Satanists in the 1970s. Yeah. There's a whole book about the fake history of the Necronomicon, the Necronomicon.
And the stuff that's actually valuable and accurate and would be accurate is put up by people who have actually been exposed to it and therefore been driven half crazy or all the way crazy. And so what they put up is going to look like it's done by a crazy person, you know? None of it's going to be systematized.
I can't take this translation of the Necronomicon seriously. It's in Comic Sans.
Yes. That is the sanity-draining, you know, font of them all.
It has it right in the title.
Yeah. Exactly. Sans Sanity.
The idea that somehow the information age is going to make things, you know, easier for the players, when, you know, you're dealing with the supernatural, all I can think of is, you know, who remembers things like spirit photography and then that wonderful spin on spirit photography that showed up in not Uzumaki, not Juon. Was that very early Japanese horror film Ringu?
Ringu, yes.
Where it's spirit photography essentially on a video medium, you know. There's any number of ways you can fuck with their players through their technology if they think that that's, you know, going to be the way that they get a leg up on the supernatural, depending on what your, you know, supernatural is.
Yeah, well, I mean, some options are, and it does provide you with a lovely clue dispenser as a GM. It's like, okay, they're stuck, it's boring. Their secretary calls them back and has, you know, completed that search with the information they need to get them to the next scene.
Right.
And then once they're dependent on that, you can terrify them by taking it away.
I think there is another factor in that, you know, even if, say, you had the Necronomicon scanned and it was on Google Books or whatever, and one, that would be terrifying, but two, it would be useless for the most part, because just having the raw information there isn't useful. You would have to have knowledge of, you know, the medieval Arabic it was written in. You'd have to have knowledge of mystery cults. You'd have to have incredibly specialized esoteric knowledge. So unless you had the equivalent of like two PhDs in this obscure occultist lore, you wouldn't be able to translate it. You wouldn't be able to make sense of it.
Yeah, that's stuff that's talked about in the Call of Cthulhu rulebook, but gets ignored really frequently, which is the text itself is not the most important thing. It's the fact that it's loaded with all kinds of, it's, you know, allusions to things that most people don't know about. You know, it's loaded with metaphors and sort of code phrases. And, so, you know, technically, and a lot of the tomes are going to be, have, you know, crap scrawled in them to try to explain some of this, but then a lot of that's probably going to be wrong.
And you know what we should totally do? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Just thrilled. I just had this idea. Now we should stick this in, you know, the new Delta Green somewhere. Is, you know, make up a page from the Necronomicon with the sigil and everything, and the marginal notes, and the old German style printing typeface, and then scan it and save it so that it's all bit jaggy, and you know, at a really low resolution. And put that in as a prop of, this is what you can download off the internet.
Well, you know, I mean, I've gone to some of these torrent sites, you know, and downloaded, just to see what it looked like, their PDFs of Delta Green and Countdown, you know. And they're, and it's stuff that people have scanned, but they scanned it on their home scanner. And so
destroy the book in the process. They didn't cut out the binding. You know, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's low resolution. It's completely splotchy. You know, the artwork is just hideous to look at because it's just a blob half the time. And that's what you're looking at when you're talking about trying to put a mythos tome that actually has horrible truths that destroy your brain when you read them online.
One of the things about mythos tomes in general, and I just want to throw this out, is that I, you know, the idea that, oh, I read the book and my head exploded, you know, okay, first of all, you got to have the medieval Arabic or the Latin or the Greek or whatever, but even there, the books to actually damage sanity, I've always felt that, you know, it's a matter of make a roll on history and physics and, you know, anthropology and realize and then make now correlate the contents, you know, that it shouldn't be, you know, there should never be an instant damage. It should always be because, oh, you figured it out. Now take the damage. Remember, ignorance is bliss, you know.
Now you can by the other token, there's another side to this, which is there are going to be times where you don't mind the players cutting to the chase and giving the details, you know? And in those cases, having the information readily available is going to be a blessing. I mean, if you read in Lovecraft's stories, I was always struck by the fact that characters in his stories had a lot more access to the nitty-gritty of the Cthulhu mythos than Call of Cthulhu player characters ever do. You know, his protagonists sort of start the thing off saying, well, it reminded me of something I'd heard about Great Cthulhu in Rillier, and you know,
I went to Miskatonic U's special library.
Yeah, all these details that Call of Cthulhu tells you nobody knows, you know, that it's secret and you don't have. It's sometimes entirely feasible to just, you know, If the heart of the horror is the players sort of piecing that stuff together and then coming to confront what ought to be, you know, fake but is in fact real and dangerous, then sometimes, you know, modern day technology, you can also make it easier to get something, but make it a surprise. You know, sprinkle that in there that they may be 90% of the time. Digging through stuff that's meaningless and that's riddled with errors and misinformation and misunderstandings and horrible Comic Sans fonts, but then they stumble on something that's the you know, it's 100% clear and truthful, and it
this puts explains them, exactly why the alien tissue acted the way it did.
Yeah, and because
this is it. This little prospectus from this, you know, guy at the University of Northern Iowa on, you know, high energy phase states. Yes, if you make your physics roll, and you now understand.
Yeah,
good
and,
for
but,
you.
But that because no, that no, because you, what you want is you want the you want ultimately the player characters to eventually get to that point. You want them.
Well,
to
this
get
is
to the horrible truth of it.
This is so much the you know, the gumshoe approach is, you know, the Robin Law's insight that spurred him to write this, he says, is that, you know, there are no great mystery stories about the detective finding or not finding the clues. Mm-hmm. It's always about the detective interpreting the clues. And, you know, so he's like, here's the big revolution. Give them the clues. You know, the suggestion I made for Delta Green is that, okay, did you fail your information gathering role? Congratulations. You've got all the information you need to destroy yourself. Mm. Did you succeed at your information gathering role? You've got all the information you need to move on to the next danger and possibly survive it.
Mm-hmm. That's not something we actually tell the players. I get that. I understand that. You know,
How badly do you want to screw yourself? A lot? It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's something that's going to have to be kept under the keeper's hat. For me, it is, because I feel like that is a factor that needs to be kept under the keeper's hat, because the keeper needs to, it does not need to be telling the players, well, you haven't found everything. Keep looking. Keep rolling your dice until you found the clue. Make your spot hit and roll, and then finally we'll move on. I take a very different tact from the gumshoe, because I'm perfectly I am willing to chance my players failing to find the clue and then proceeding without it. If I've written a scenario that is so tightly wound that they can't proceed unless they make a spot hidden roll, and I'm only going to give them one chance to make it. I'm a retard. I can't. I think that I'm willing to. I think it takes a little work, but building a scenario where there are multiple opportunities for failure, you know, clearly Dennis and I diverge on that, because even his scenarios eat players if they do everything right. I'm willing to allow, I think that, you know, allowing for, well, you never talked to that witness, you know, if the players breeze through and never talk to the children in the neighborhood, I mean, God knows I've been in scenarios where, you know, the only answer was in some kid, and we had to get the kid away from their parents because they'd have to admit that, you know, we were out after curfew. You know, and they're not going to do that in front of their, you know, their parents. That's tough. That's really sort of a dodgy scenario, but.
Well, it's pixel bitching, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
yeah. Well, I think.
For those of you who are not familiar with the term pixel bitching, I think that came from RPG.net, but that refers to the old adventure games, you know, the click and point adventure games where Gabriel Knight and those kind of things, where you would have to look on the screen and find the clue that is literally one pixel by one pixel and click on that one little corner of the screen.
Or the horrifying text games where you didn't say hurl object, you know, you didn't say hurl spear, you said throw spear so you die.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. That,
yeah.
Well, you have wiggle room.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think.
And you have to be willing, if it's a core clue. You just have to be, you know, you just hand that out. That's obvious. You know, it's like, oh, you don't have to roll to spot the giant idol in the middle of the room.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, some of that stuff you're just going to have to accept that you're going to have to spoon feed the players, that they don't have to roll spot hidden to notice the knife sticking out of the corpse. You know?
Well, I think we may want to, get back on point as far as historical stuff, because we could let's save this, because we ought to make one of the
whole new episode. Yeah, we're getting ahead.
I think we ought to make one of our episodes big points specifically about randomness in this kind of horror investigative games, because that's a whole giant issue, and we ought to
get Robin on.
Ought to get Ken or Robin on to talk about that and do some sort of point.
I do want to make one point, and that is one of the things I recently did an episode on RPPR about Call of Cthulhu. We sort of talked about some of the same issues, and I came to realize that Call of Cthulhu is one of the easiest role playing games. For new players, someone who's not familiar with role playing at all, or maybe he's only played D&D, to get into, because it's a very simple system. You're playing a human with, you know, human abilities. You're not a wizard or a robot or whatever. So it's very easy to play, but it's also, conversely, one of the hardest games to run, because there's so many of these kind of issues that aren't clearly spelled out in the rules, but new GMs were like, oh, make spot hiddens to see everything, or, you know, let's have lots of combat, or, you know, and the Call of Cthulhu has some of the best written scenarios in the industry, period. But it also has ones where it's like, this is a strictly historical game, but in the end, you'll be fighting 30 cultists in black robes, and you'll have a Tommy gun, and the turn into dungeon crawls. So you have these sort of wildly oscillating materials, and so it's very easy to play, very hard to run.
Yeah, and that's the
sort funny of, how that works
that's,
out.
That's the sort of thing that I definitely want to. Make sure it's squarely addressed in the Delta Green game, because it's a big sort of piece that's always been kind of missing from the Call of Cthulhu core rules that people have had to
Right.
But let's talk some more about sort of different eras. I mean, we've talked a lot about information and the challenge.
Well, one thing I'd like to mention is, or sort of bring up about the very, we've been talking about research and, you know, when to inform players of the social mores or the rules of different eras and whatever. But I think, you know, I'd like to know from each of you, what are the things you always research, you always know ahead of time for whatever here? Because, for example, one of the things I learned from the Yakuza game is that I should always learn what the law enforcement is like in a given time period if I'm running a game there. Like, when are the cops going to show up, and what are they going to do to the players when they, you know, burn the house down or whatever? I mean, that's regardless of whatever era I'm running. That's one of the things I'm going to look up from now on.
Yeah.
What about you? I mean, what are the universal things you always look up? Or are there any?
Well, yeah. First of all, you're going to know what game you're running. Yeah. And that's going to heavily inform what kind of choices your players are going to make. You're going to know probably, maybe, who your players are, and that'll inform it. But more to the point, because even if it's a con game, every game has sort of built-in assumptions of what the players are going to be doing and what challenges they're going to be overcoming. And that's where you sort of start. So if you're setting your game in another historical era, you still know it's a Call of Cthulhu game, so you still know that the player characters are going to be talking to people, they're going to be asking a lot of questions, they're probably going to want to be armed, they're probably going to want to know when they can start shooting people. They're probably going to want to do some breaking and entering, most Call of Cthulhu games, there are exceptions, obviously, and there are a lot of Lovecraftian purists that are going to point to everything I've just said as reasons Call of Cthulhu becomes terrible. But in my experience, the game usually winds up being about characters trying to find all this information that other people don't want them to have. And so there's research, there's interviews, there's breaking and entering, there's the possibility of fights and gunfights. And so your research on the era needs to key on those sort of core things. What does research look like in this time and place? What are the social implications of interviewing and interrogating, particularly interrogating when they don't want to talk to you, different kinds of people by the people by the investigators and what kind of culture they come from. If you're talking about Japan, for instance, right after World War II, are the player characters native? Are they Japanese or are they Americans? And if they're Americans, then it's entirely possible that they'll have spent several years in absolutely horrific combat with the kinds of people they're going to be interviewing. And that's going to have to inform the way that they interact. What do communications look like? I mean, when the player characters are going to want to get information, how do they do it? What do the laws look like? If a player says, I want to have a pistol in my pocket and a Tommy gun in the back seat, or an Uzi, or whatever is appropriate, how do they get that, and what's the implication if somebody else sees it, or if a police officer sees it? So that's to me, those are the things you start with, is what do you know? Put yourself in the player's shoes, and if you were in this investigation, what kinds of things would you be doing? And then put yourself back in the keeper's shoes, and how are you going to describe that stuff?
Shane's covered a lot of good stuff. Something else I tend to do is geography at all scales, not just in the broad sense of, okay, here's a map of the village you're in, or here's a map of the neighborhood you're in, but what are the buildings they're going to go through? What are they like? How are they, how can I describe them vividly? How can I put them in place so that they know what's around them? I think that sort of provides immediacy. I mean, it's like theater. You have to have good set dressing and you have to have good costuming. Even if it's just a few small details, you don't need to have a huge elaborate costume where everything's perfect. If you've got one thing that their attention is on that is perfect.
That's a perfect analogy, in fact. Yeah. I mean, if you think of theater and stagecraft, I mean, not talking about sort of big Broadway productions where they fill in all the details, but think of sort of low-key theater productions where the backdrop is a black cloth, and the goal is to sort of give you one or two details that'll evoke the whole rather than trying to give you all the details.
I'll give you an example from one of the games that I think is archived on RRPR, which is the one we played with the fighter planes, remember?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Gen Con last year. Yeah.
And the detail that sticks with me from that is that, each of you has a Webley revolver on a tether, and, you will want to keep this close because you don't have a parachute. It's believed that if they issued you a parachute, it would encourage you to abandon your plane. So the joke is that, you know, you will keep this close to, you know, spare yourself a lingering death in the event of a crash. And I'm like, that's it. I know it, I don't have to know anything else about, you know, okay, you know, good detail about why you have to have the scarf because of all the oil blowing back in your face, but I don't need to know about the pants or the shoes or, you know, what's on my belt or anything of that sort.
I'm glad I included that detail, Mr. Stolze, because it does sort of neatly sum up the technology of the aircraft and the horrifying attitudes of your commanders.
Well, and you know, the scarf, I loved hearing that about the scarves, because that never occurred to me, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a detail that I think it actually came up in play, but it's a sort of detail where it's not really...
Your goggles, your face, your hair, it's all covered in crap.
Right. It's not going to necessarily change the decisions you make as a player, but it was a great little piece of trivia that made you feel a little bit closer to the character.
Well, certainly in an earlier version of the game, a nose gunner on a... on a bomber in the game, a Hadley Page bomber, ended up putting both barrels of his Lewis gun into the Biaki that was climbing up the front of the aircraft, and it was blown to ribbons, and everyone made luck rolls, and those who failed ended up being blinded with monster guts on their glasses, and then furiously trying to clear their goggles, you know, so they can see the next coming attack, although the smart guys just pulled their goggles up.
Right.
You know, and you know, and saw the next monster coming, but somebody was desperately trying to clear his goggles and got bit.
Yeah. You know? but then again, for the smart guy, the next time you get a face full of Biaki,
yeah.
How are you going to clear that off?
Wow, face full of Biaki, huh? All right.
That's going to be my darkest of hillside. That's the key, because that's bad.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of concern I was worried about when I was running the Yakuza game too. Was like, are the players going to feel like they're actually, you know, their characters are actually in Japan in this time, in this place, rather than just I just file the serial numbers off and they're just, you know, gangsters in generic city, you know, 101. Yeah. And that's kind of like the tricky thing. You don't want to make it so alien that they don't understand anything, but you don't want to make it so normal that it's just like not special or interesting.
In Las Vegas or whatever, right?
Well, even Las Vegas is too interesting, you know, generic city.
Well, I think that you have to really come to grips with the culture that you're dealing with and to make the nature of that culture central to the scenario you're running.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I hear Yakuza, I'm like, no, they don't behave like, you know, Al Capone's mob.
They have
a different ethos, and they have a different set of cultural signifiers. And those were those central to your game? Because if they are, that's what's going to drag people into characterization and make them really identify and have it be this is a Yakuza game, not just this is a gangster game that happens to be set in Japan, so the gangsters are Yakuza.
Right. But it has to be, because if that's all it is a gangster game. Where the Yakuza is just the name and the paint, you know, then that's much less interesting, and you're kind of wasting your players' time with that detail. You know,
unless you're all on board with the idea that we're just going to take the westernized, you know, poorly educated gloss on this, and that, you know, if you all agree that, oh no, that's just set dressing there to be cool, then it can actually, you know, be cool, but if you are willing to put more into it, you probably will get more out of it.
Mm-hmm. Let me just throw out, I think, again, Shane did cover most of the details that I, you know, I want to be concerned about in a Call of Cthulhu game, but you covered most of the main things. What's communications like in this area? What are the long distance? Is it telegraph? Is there a telephone line? Are you going to pay somebody to get on a horse and carry a note? What's research look like under these circumstances? What's the access to violence look like? You know, what are our weapons? What are our access to weapons? And it's one of the things that has always been sadly missing from Mass of Nyarlathotep is that you start off in America, where we all know in 1925 you can still buy a Thompson machine gun through mail order, and they'll just deliver it to your house in a package. Okay, that's great, but now I got to go to London. Now I got to go to Cairo, which is a which is an independent country, but kind of sort of a British protectorate. And then I got to go to, you know, Crown Colony of Kenya, and then to Shanghai. And oh wait, it's a there's this whole concept of extraterritoriality. Yet it's really a Chinese city. You know, yeah, you want to know the big things are, since it's a mystery game and since it's Call of Cthulhu, those are the kind of things you have to consider. And yeah, you always have to consider the cops, because the players are going to do illegal shit. You need to know what does, you know, what is the police response going to look like in different eras? And I think that's, you know, I think that's really critical.
And how honest are they, or how corruptible are they?
Exactly.
And how much do the player, should the player characters know about that? Is the assumption that the cops are on the ball and they're going to be, you know, really doing their work? Or is the cultural assumption that the cops are there because it's a cushy way to get payoffs? And
there I'm trying to remember even where I read this. It was some guy who'd gone in to help train police officers in some Mexican city in like the 40s or something. And he was like, these guys didn't know how to load their revolvers. All they were using them for is they would drag in suspects and beat them with the handle of the gun.
Right.
Yeah. And there's stories like that out of the latest Libyan thing, where these American Libyans, these guys had grown up in America, their parents had to skedaddle, and they went back to Libya for the latest dust up, and they went back having done a tour or two with the army, got back, and yeah, it was horrifying what people didn't know, how amateurish it was. And you go to, you know, the difference between the metropolitan cops in, say, London versus the cops in rural America, you know, where just rural America in the same time period in like the 1920s, it's pretty stunning. You know, we're talking about elected officials. The sheriff is just somebody everybody likes, you know, or who has got enough votes, and who knows what the quality of the cronies are that he's brought to the event, you know, brought to the, and given out these jobs that are, you know, spoils of the election.
One thing I stick in, as long as we're talking about the you know, the pros and cons of incompetent police, is that you really want to have that cut both ways. It would be fascinating to run a game where it's just like, no, the police are totally on. They are all over this. And that has kept the Mythos incursion contained, is not that they know anything, but just that they do their jobs so well that it can't, that it's having trouble getting a tentacle in edgewise. Yeah. But at the same time, if you go off the reservation, they are on your shit, and they are sharp, and you can't talk them around, and you can't buy them off.
Yeah. Or which means the big
then change it up and have
secret.
You know, yeah, and change it up and have it be, oh, okay, well, welcome to Podunkville, and you know, the sheriff's getting on in years, and yeah, you can get away with anything as long as you're quiet enough. And the cultists around have been getting away with everything because they're quiet enough.
Well, how to deal with policing in these kind of games is that's going to be its own 2-hour discussion. But I'll just say that one thing that's going to be key to bear in mind, and you need to decide this or do the research to figure it out, with any era where you're playing in any locale where you're setting your game, is when you're talking about the police, what are they actually trying to do? You know, and in the modern day, in every jurisdiction in the United States and in anywhere you go in the world, the function that the police are said to be filling is usually kind of far removed from the function that the police officers are actually trying to fill. Because what the police are said to be doing, even in the best case scenario, is reducing crime and putting the bad guys away and that kind of thing. And but in order to accomplish that, they have a giant bureaucracy. and they spend most of their time kind of doing things that enable them to check certain boxes on the right paperwork. And sometimes that process results in a person who's actually done a bad thing going to jail for a long time. But a lot of time that process results in, you know, really wayward kind of questioning and, you know, and decisions being made. And it's really common to get in situations where the cops, and especially the higher up you go, are not, you know, they're making decisions based on making sure the records look good, and and have much less invested in actually changing things, because the fact is, police officers learn really quickly that what they do is not going to make immediate lasting change, and therefore this sort of cynicism sets in where they quickly learn to not give a shit. I think anybody that's interested in gaming and doing and police needs to watch The Wire and watch the entirety of it, and watch it more than once, because those guys were not just making that shit up. You know, that's a culture, and that's a sort of a story about a culture that's based very heavily in the reality of American police work.
Mm-hmm. What was the line from the Wire where it's not your turn to give a fuck?
Oh yeah, that's what McNulty is, sort of one of the main protagonists.
Yeah, who can't stop
screw up, and he's sort of really really self destructive. But the story, the sort of the series, part of the key of the series is exploring what makes him so self destructive, and what shape does that take. And his partner, you know, his partner just sort of shakes his head occasionally. Yeah, and he says to him that, there you go again, giving a shit when it's not your turn to give a shit.
Yeah.
That's a fact of life. And so when you're wanting to deal with what are the police like in an exotic locale or in a strange era, that's a question you need to ask, is what's the distinction between what they say they're there to do and what they actually are doing?
Yeah.
Police certainly are not there to create disorder. The police are there to preserve disorder.
Certainly when you're going to do most Call of Cthulhu scenarios, a lot of them involve crime that has happened, a death, a theft. There's a lot of scenarios that run like that. And for the players to show up and solve the supernaturally motivated or supernaturally executed crime, in the face of the police failing to, for me, it's always important to either, you know, you said it during the classic era, a little police incompetence is no problem. You know, I can understand, because the lack of professional standards, the lack of training, the lack of forensics outside of the major metropolitan areas. You get to the modern age, and if the cultists show up and, you know, kill Elias Jackson with a pointy stick with a spike in it, you know, in the middle of a hotel in New York, you know, in 2005. Rather than 1925, Lieutenant Poole of the NYPD doesn't need the players. You know what I mean? They're going to police this shit up. Bingo, bango, bongo. It's done. You know,
bearing in mind that what Lieutenant Poole needs is a conviction. He doesn't need to know that there was a cult involved. He doesn't need to know that there's some grand world spanning conspiracy.
Oh yeah.
You know, what he needs is to be able to sign off saying we have
the evidence trail is clear.
Right.
Here it is.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that they got the right evidence. That doesn't mean that they got the killer. That doesn't mean anything. All it means is that what he needs is to be able to say this case is solved. you know, our stats are slightly better because this case is off of our book.
Okay, now. That really brings your point all together for me now. That last statement, you know, that yeah. You know, even if you have a modern setting game where the cops, the FBI, whoever has really got their shit together and really can do their job, they're going to come to an end of a trail. It's these three guys broke into Elias Jackson's room and killed him. Mm-hmm. You know, their, you know, motivation of why they did it, you know, did somebody give the order? Or are they going to just clam up because they're good, you know, loyal cultists and just say, gee, we just thought it up on our own and did it. You know, that may satisfy.
We did it for the lulls.
Yeah. Well, you know, that may satisfy.
For police, motive doesn't really matter. You know, you're not going to be able to use motive to secure a conviction most of the time because motive is mercurial and it changes.
And unless it's obvious, you can't really prove it.
But that's the thing, is it's not evidence, you know? Yeah. And the only way that motive matters in terms of evidence is if knowing the motive enables you to persuade a suspect to confess, and then that confession becomes evidence. So,
juries really don't. Juries really do not get swayed by it. But what's the motive?
Well, they can't. They're not allowed to. I mean, they're positively forbidden from it because that's not evidence that somebody did something. It's a sort of subjective assertion that somebody had a reason to do something. But that's not the same thing as proof that it was done by that person. So
there's all kinds of things that I'm motivated to do, but too lazy to enact.
Yeah. So, but that's the thing, is, you know, dealing with police investigations in these games, you know, bear in mind that the investigators, the player characters, are there for very different reasons than the police are there. And if they run into a cop who's dedicated to the truth and who's dedicated to getting to the bottom of this, that cop number one might be the least popular cop on the police force because he keeps cases open that otherwise might be solved, and he makes the police force look like it's incompetent because they're not checking those boxes off, you know?
Yeah.
And number two, he might get involved in stuff that'll get him killed when other police are not wanting to get involved with it, you know.
I mean, they don't want to rock the boat.
Don't always assume that when there's a cop involved, the cop is necessarily doing everything right for the right reasons. They might be, and a lot of them are. And don't get me wrong, not every police force is the Baltimore PD of The Wire. But they were what The Wire did successfully was sort of key in on elements of American police culture that are ubiquitous enough that you can find them and you can find traces of them just about wherever you go.
And
let me push this pendulum back in another direction a little bit and say that if you are in any kind of first response job or any kind of emergency response job and you cannot create a distance between yourself and your work, you will just burn out. You will not hold that job very long if you are a social worker who feels this tight, profound, deep inner emotional connection with every molested child you talk with. Well, you know, you're probably going to provide some great caring intervention for your first 10, and then you're going to quit to go off to a farm somewhere in the middle of the nowhere and spend every day quietly sobbing. Yeah.
That's absolutely the case. And, I mean, I see that all the time, and that's a good thing to bear in mind. You know, people that are in those jobs that player characters might interact with, you know, it's a mistake to make them as passionate about what they're encountering as the player characters might be, because professionals who have to deal with that stuff, exactly like Greg says, they have to get a thick skin, and that means they have to be able to turn it off, and you can't turn it off if it breaks your heart every day.
Yeah, you're a doctor and a nurse, I mean, when your shift ends, you're like, okay, bad things happen today. They're going in the drawer. Now I'm going home, and I'm going to get a cheeseburger.
Yeah, the downside of that, of course, is that you know, when
you can take it too far.
Well, when those people deal with quote unquote civilians, you know, they can seem like real assholes. You know, because if the situation is, you know, my son just got murdered, you know, and then the cop is in here and he clearly is just doing his day-to-day job and clearly doesn't give a crap. And the paramedics are in here, and they're just clearly, it's just another day on the job for them. You know, that makes me think those people are all creeps, you know. But that's a thing that you can bring in as a keeper in a game, is that sense that these are people that are dealing with this a lot, you know, and they're not really approaching it from the same emotional level as the players might even expect them to.
Let me throw in the standard thing that I guess always gets brought up whenever we talk about doing different time periods. And maybe it's an entire, you know, broadcast to itself, but when it's time to shock the players and shock their sensibilities, you can do that very easily by just, you know, bringing in the standards and social, standards of the era, you know, racism, sexism being the classic examples of shocking the player's sensibilities. Well, a woman can't do that job. A black man can't come into this hotel. Right. A Jew cannot be a member of this club. I'm in favor of never backing away from that stuff in a game. And if players want to play a female character or a character who's a minority in any particular country, like say they want to play an Irishman in England, you know, I don't see any reason why that shouldn't happen. But I don't think keepers should back away from inflicting the time and place on the players.
Right.
I think the key. There's an example during listening to the Yogg-Sothoth.com guys playing Mass Narotep. They get a lead from this guy who runs a warehouse who refers to the evil priest. He doesn't know he's the evil priest, but he refers to the evil priest in New York, the African who's the evil priest in Narothotep in New York, as that nigger, you know, or he refers to him as a darkie, or he uses some racial language to describe the guy. The players immediately had sympathy for the cultist and immediately presumed that the warehouse owner, because he's a racist prick, mm-hmm. is also a murderous cultist. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I remember listening to that going, oh my God, that, you know, ow, way to let your, you know, modern sensibilities completely misdirect you. Mm. It's the kind of thing that, you know, I wouldn't mind, you know, having turn up in a game. But I feel like as a keeper, I'd have to, you know, question them. Because I think he made some comments that were both racist and about, well, I don't think that guy's any good. And they're like, well, of course he doesn't think he's any good. He's, you know, this guy's a racist. He doesn't think the black guy's good. So we can stop that line of investigation now. Because clearly...
That's a really good example. I mean, there's another way I thought that it could apply too. And going back with what we were talking earlier, it's the policing. And I know we talked about this a little, but we were talking mostly about policing from Western country standards, especially in the relatively modern era. If you go to societies that aren't nearly as free, like, say, pre-Russian Revolution Russia, you know, the secret police, or North Korea today, then you have very drastically different standards for policing. And then they players find out, to example, they just assign, you know, the secret police assign that guy is the one who killed these people. We're just going to execute him without a trial. So
certainly the documentation looks good. You know,
yeah, exactly.
And that's another situation where if the investigators start digging around in the case, well, guess what? They're trying to stir shit up that nobody wants stirred up. And that's one more reason for them to be on the radar of police in a bad way.
Something I'll throw in the idea of the different racial and gender standards of different eras is that you can cut both ways with that, too. There was this great Joe Lansdale novel, I think it was called The Bottoms, and it was set in the Texas of like the 40s or 50s, and the serial killer is operating around this little Texas area, traveling in and out, and one of the things that happens is that uh, the the doctor who's sort of, I think it was the doctor's son is investigating this, and he's like 12 years old and is just sort of bumbling around because he's an unsupervised child. Mm. And, you know, comes in on his dad talking with the black community's doctor. And, you know, none of the blacks will say anything to the sheriff, to the white sheriffs. And, you know, and they won't talk to the white doctor. And, but, oh, yeah. You know, the white dead doctor man. And the black doctor are the only point of data contact. Sharing mm-hmm. between yeah. these two communities.
Because it's not going to be the religious leaders. They're not going to talk to each other. It's going to have to be the medical professionals. Now, Dead Man Stomp does a pretty good job of illustrating the racial divide in America in the 20s. I was always very happy with Dead Man Stomp in that aspect. But just like you say, Greg, you can play that other ways. I remember a story, and I do not know the source of it, but somebody claimed that they built their Call of Cthulhu group around a detective agency, and one of the operatives who worked for the detective agency was a black female character whose primary job was, if they needed a hotel room search, she'd put on the maid's uniform and she'd go in and she'd search it, and they'd, when the cultists came back and caught her, she'd just start turning the bed down, and yep. she was invisible.
Yes.
And they'd even talk in front of her. She'd like, you know, she could bring room service and be pouring, you know, drinks, and they'd be talking in front of her because she's invisible. And I thought, that's freaking brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes, there are. I mean, if you're running a game set in Victorian England, I mean, there are things that a woman in that society will not tell to any man.
When last we left our Intrepid Heroes, Mr. Stolze was talking about we were right in the middle of
I was on my high horse about
that. There's things you're never going to be able to interrogate a female suspect and get certain answers to certain questions. It's simply not going to happen unless you put hot coals under her feet, you know, and because
the opens up its own box of worms,
because the culture simply will not allow it,
you know, right,
under any circumstances.
Well, I was thinking about that Yakuza game. Is that, you know, okay, if you've got you know, Japanese in occupied Japan right after the war has ended, and you know, you're calling, who's going to call in the American police when, you know, shit goes pear-shaped? It's like, okay, yeah, well, we've got this problem with the MIGO, but how many cities of ours did they destroy with unholy fire? Oh, zero?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would actually probably prefer their authority to yours, Round Eyes.
Yeah. And certainly that's the classic bit from the David Drake short story, Then Curse the Darkness. It's been reprinted a few times, but he's got, set in the Belgian Congo before the.
Oh, tournament. Yeah. That one was awesome.
Yeah. And they're, it's, why would anyone join up with the Cthulhu mythos? And it's like, well, I'll tell you why. Because they're, you know, they're getting their hands chopped off and they're getting castrated and they're getting their eyeballs shot out by the, you know, by the Congo, you know, the force publique from the Congo Free State. You know? Mm-hmm. That's why they're joining up with.
That was the review I wrote for The Oath.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, so. Yeah. Did you get it out of Book of Cthulhu?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, Book of Cthulhu actually has some of my all-time favorites in there. Some really, really good collection. Not the least of which, because it's got a Colder War in there, and up until now I was not happy with the other collections it exists in, but now I have it. Oh, moving right along. So
when you're talking about running one of these horror games in another era, you know, the Cthulhu, one of the easiest ways to plug the Cthulhu mythos in, or whatever the source of horror is, as a kind of tool. You know, it's a thing that people are turning to because they need something, because they lack power, or because they're victimized, or whatever. And so you can sort of play, you know, you can use it as a, you can use that as a sort of springboard to kind of explore what are the issues, you know, that are really, really hitting people hard. And that'll give you a lot of details
to explore the to have the players exploring the setting, and also to affect what are the characters that they can interact with and how, you know, the NPCs, how do the NPCs react to the players, whether it's NPCs that are sort of in on the evil or what.
Mm-hmm. There's actually
go ahead, Greg.
Your thing with the maid, there's a an online comic called Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, and there was I think my favorite comic strip from it is where this guy's like, physics is actually building an invisibility cloak, something that makes light waves pass around solid objects. It's going to be just like Harry Potter. Isn't that incredible? And the other guy says, psh, sociologists have had invisibility cloaks for decades. Mm-hmm. It's like, what the hell are you talking about? Sociology isn't even really a science. Oh my God, where did you go? You see the sociologist just holding up this piece of cardboard with homeless, please help.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, another thing that occurred to me, and this is kind of, you know, I mean, this is something that most people know instinctively, but, you know, if you're going to be bringing in stuff from another culture and stuff that has to do with racism and sexism and classism and all that, you want to get on the same page as your players. You know, you want to make sure that you're not going to be hitting, hitting any hot buttons that are going to really disturb your players when...
There's the good kind of disturbance and the bad kind of disturbance.
Oh, well
just,
you know.
Just get them on the same page.
But that's true. That's true for anything you bring in. You want to know who your players are before you go, today's scenario is going to be about set in a mental institution, and whoops, maybe somebody got to spend some time in one, or incarcerated, or this one's going to involve, you know, at some point it's going to involve
molestation.
All the classic, you know, easy one, molestation, you know, and you need to know what your players are, what depth they're pressurized to before you start throwing a lot of stuff at them. I just suddenly flashed on something, speaking of again the difference in eras, when we were writing one of the scenarios for Bumps in the Night, there's this thing where you're canvassing a neighborhood as the police. And as you're going along canvassing the neighborhood, looking for, you know, trying to check on the well-being of people in the neighborhood, find out if anyone's died, there was a bit where, you know, as written, you go into a house and you find out that the owner, as you're searching for him, if you start looking through his stuff, because you can get into his house, nobody's there, you knock, you know, you've already found houses with corpses in them, and now you're trying to find out how many. You start looking through his stuff to see if he's gone out for the day, you know, where you get any clues. You can come across his stash of, as originally written, child porn. And I thought, you know, it's 1920 whatever in this scenario. Why does it have to be child porn? Mm. It's a felony if it's just porn, you know, with consenting adults. He could be going to jail for years just having this stuff in his possession. You know, change it to regular porn just to shock the sensibilities of our players going, no, this is a big deal. This is not French postcards. It's, it's a little more salacious than that. But, you know, just to let them know this isn't it says America right on the label and the city.
It's not the America you're used to.
Yeah. Yeah. The little detail, again, that's back to policing, what laws are, you know, going to be enforced. The classic one being, you know, what guns can I carry? Everybody always wants to know that as a player. But different eras are also going to provide a lot of different, frankly, the further back in time you go, the options for player action without consequence really get wider, in my humble opinion. When it's the 2000s, I can totally understand it if players are, you know, when it comes to big horde of cultists, let's say there's a compound filled with armed cultists about to commit a human sacrifice and summon Yogg-Sothoth. Well, you can't get the cops interested in stopping the summoning of Yogg-Sothoth, but a whole bunch of creepy guys with guns in a compound about to murder somebody. Mm. Yeah, you can get the cops interested in that, you know, and they'll show up, you know, like they'll hit it like the Marines in Okinawa. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that I would see happening more often. And the more modern a game is, the more sort of default to you gather up enough clues to motivate the authorities to deal with something they understand.
You set it off.
Yeah, and then you police up the real problem, hopefully, around the edges. When it's playing in, say your players are playing Cthulhu Invictus, and you've watched the Rome series off HBO, so you think you got a handle on Roman culture, and probably not a bad start, really. And hacking down anyone who's not a Roman citizen with a sword is like, that's like jaywalking. It's not really going.
Stop doing that, or I will have to tell you to stop doing it again.
Yeah, exactly. Who's going to clean this mess up now that you've gutted all these Gauls?
Well, I mean, you can find places in the modern world where things are that wild and woolly too. You don't even have to go back in time. It's just
But. The player is being dropped into some place like Somalia, it's going to be that wild and woolly, but most of the places that are that fucked up have the addition of being so fucked up that you can't protect yourself from how fucked up it is.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, and if it's a, if it's a modern day group of investigators and they don't happen to all be Somalian, then when they jump in and to that situation and it's that much anarchy, when things start going wrong and people start panicking, who are they going to key in on but the strangers who seem to be stirring it all up?
There was an incident in the late 90s in Guatemala where a woman was killed because a rumor started that the adoption agency she represented was using the children for spare parts for American babies. Okay. It was just a standard kind of, they're putting the blood in the matzah kind of blood libel rumor. Right. Started up, next thing she gets lynched or killed with machetes or something horrible. And it didn't take long for that to get rolling. And so, for the crowd to turn on the players if they're in some shitty corner of the world, it does not take long for that to get started. And it may even, sometimes I wonder if there's not even a propensity to that more in the modern age because there's so much more media distributed over such a wider net, that wacky rumors of babies used for body parts from one corner of the globe can end up landing in another,
Well, and there's a huge divide between, what's said and what's believed. As I understand it, if you take a poll in China, most educated Chinese citizens do not believe that the United States landed a mission on the moon. They think the whole thing was faked. Yeah. Whereas, come on.
Right. And in modern day Japan, I've heard stories to the effect that a lot of Japanese know very little about what actually happened in World War II.
Yeah, they that whole Nanking thing didn't happen. Yeah. And apparently they were minding their own business in 1945 when we just flew over and nuked them. certainly while reading Mark Bowden's Guest to the Ayatollah, there's a moment where our educated Iranian college student is yelling at the Americans during one of their sort of recreational, attempts to indoctrinate, the Americans that they've got at the embassy and show them how bad they are. They brought out the example of, well, you're a terrible country. You nuked Japan. He's like, yeah, and? Well, how can you justify that? Well, we were at war with them. You were? Yes! Yes, we were at war with them! We were at war with Japan! They attacked us at Pearl Harbor! What's Pearl Harbor? Wait a minute! those kind of gulfs are the kind of things that, those kind of gulfs are the kind of things that if you were to, I would love to be able to, find ways of working things like that into scenarios because it seems incredible incredible. It seems unbelievable that there could be those kind of gulfs.
Well, and then it, of course, makes you wonder, okay, well, what's the bullshit that I've been fed and I believe? Because it's surely, you know, okay.
The founding fathers, you know, crap marble and, you know, do no wrong. Yeah, that's one of them.
Well, and it, from a Call of Cthulhu standpoint as well, if the player characters are in a place that where they're exotic, you know, and the players, you know, are exotic, then that can be kind of a gold mine for the keeper, you know, where you're going to be feeding, they're going to be talking to people and getting all kinds of weird information, and you know, and you can actually have a lot of kind of mischievous fun, I expect, with
yeah, that's a very good point. I don't want to just, like, you know, sort of, part of this sounds like we're saying, well, you know, the players have to be prepared to encounter all kinds of disturbing ignorance no matter where they go in whatever era they're in. But certainly you can turn that on its head and, you know, find ways of, for instance, I'm going to just throw out one of my favorite punching bags, the French. Everything I've been reading recently I've been reading a lot of stuff set between the wars, travel logs, history books, and what I'm coming across is that Americans do not have this anti-French bias between the wars. Our experience with the French in World War I was much better than our experience with the British. Mm. The British were still hugely class conscious, and we were all peasants. All our officers were peasants, according to their officer class. I mean, meanwhile, you know, on the other side of the fence, the French, you know, their first.
You're coming to help? Great.
Yeah. Their marshal was a guy whose dad was like a shoemaker or something. Whereas, you know, the British, Lord French, who was the first British BEF commander. He's like the third Marquess of, you know, Shrewsbury or something. And our experience with the French was much better. Than we seem to have now. Our relationships, cultural relationships, were much better. We were not, you know, the slobby Americans who are dirtying up their Paris. You know, that just simply doesn't exist. And to have the players thrown into a situation where they have perhaps a not so good time dealing with the Brits, who we think of as our natural, you know, brothers in arms, and but the French treat them, you know, better. Little weird, confounding things like that in a scenario add color and flavor. Mm-hmm. You know,
but we speak the same language as the British. Yes, so you can understand every word when he insults you. You can pick up the little subtleties how he's saying, implying that not only are you uncultured, but that your mom probably is uncultured.
But, you know, things like that are, I don't know, worthwhile for color in a scenario. But how to horrify your players with different eras, I've been wanting to throw this in. In issue 5 of Worlds of Cthulhu, Aaron Vanek published a scenario, and I may have mentioned it before, called They Sleep by Twilight.
Okay, I haven't heard of it.
This scenario, essentially, he went and he just did an enormous amount of research on rinky-dink spiritualists of the 1920s, and then also did a whole bunch of research into childbirth.
Okay.
And childbirth in the 1920s, all these things that are normal for childbirth and prenatal care are going to seem like that the poor mother is being prepared like she's going to give birth to Rosemary's baby. Hmm. You know, it's going to come off as weird and occulty and unpleasant and strange, and clearly they're up to something when it's just the standards of the day. You know, it's an extremely well done scenario because it's filled with misdirection, with, you know, the banal 1920s spiritualists. Well, they're the cultists. Clearly we have to shoot them with Tommy guns, you know, when they're just these bored middle-class people who are, you know, looking for some diversion because there's nothing on television right now. And then the childbirth stuff is the same way. And, you know, all these things, which are the standards of the day, come off as strange and unpleasant and weird. And the big thing being the step in the 1920s towards knocking women the heck out during childbirth, you know, which produces, you know, because they don't, they're not awake during the process. This is the first generation where we start getting these sort of weird instances of women going to sleep, waking up, and there's a baby. And then being like, well, it's not my baby. I have no connection to it. How do I know, you know, it's mine? You know, where's my baby? You know, and these sort of panics that gripped the country of, you know, baby snatching were the result of some of these early, you know, these early attempts to, you know,
make the process a little less uncomfortable.
Yeah, and failing completely, you know.
Oh, no, I'm sure that it was less uncomfortable to be knocked out than to go through childbirth. I mean, but yeah, there's the unanticipated consequence of, you know, well, the photos are it didn't happen. Yeah.
So things like that, you know, Aaron built an entire scenario around using the something simple like that every woman and every family is going to do. He used that as a fulcrum in the entire scenario. And as far as trying to do things like that in the trying to, you know, that's a real trick. I'm really pleased with his results. Vanek's one of the guys who does the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. He runs it down in L.A. these days. That's really the hardest trick for me is the idea of taking something out of another period and using that as the, you know, something that may be, I don't know, not unique but close to it, you know.
Well, I think that's a good argument for doing your research, but then making sure that the research you do matters, you know.
And
that,
yes,
that
exactly.
Use it as an ingredient that's going to inform the players something useful about the mystery.
And it really is fascinating the way that Call of Cthulhu in particular lends itself so well to historical, it's this view of history in just about every era. And I think that part of the reason that works, there's a lot of different factors that contribute to this being fun. And one is the mythos gives us such an extreme other who is so unconcerned with human ideals and mores that, you know, okay, this is something that no matter how alien I am from a 14th century Chinese monk, you know, we're brothers under the skin compared to one of the ego.
Yeah.
And so there will always be that motive to get involved, and it makes sense because the mythos will always be the threat that is beyond you and incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. But I think the sort of mirror image of that is that that mythos ground state of total depravity then gives you a sort of a frame in which you can look at historical stuff like that Belgian Congo story, or where you can look at, okay, well, how different can a culture be? And, you know, it's horrible and but you know, it's still human, and compared to the deep ones, well, yeah, you got to side with the humanity.
Well, you know, not to flog another company's products too much, but let's go talk about Chaosium's Strange Aeons 1 and 2. Are you guys familiar with those two books?
Nope.
All right, Strange Aeons 1 was from the maybe early 90s, and it was three scenarios set in, I think it was Elizabethan England, Spain during the Inquisition, like the Renaissance or maybe earlier, and then there was one scenario set on the moon. It was just these standalones using different times and places. And the first one was a very slim volume. The second Strange Aeons was a lot beefier. And when you said Chinese monk, it made me think they, you know, there's a story set in China. There's a story set, you know, in Mijie, Japan. There's a story set. The most intriguing one is set amongst a group of Neanderthals.
Oh, cool.
Where the player characters are mammoth hunters. And they encounter the remnants of one of these horrible pre-human Mu-like civilizations. I can't remember which one. And, you know, talk about your alien technology. Oh, my God, they have buildings. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, and...
Quest they, for Fire at yeah, the Mountains of Madness.
Exactly. That is exactly what it comes out as. And, you know, so Strange Aliens does a pretty good job of... trying to, you know, sort of showcase that, yeah, I got a scenario set during the Cavaliers and the Roundheads in the English Civil War. I've got one, you know, I can't remember all the scenarios and off the top of my head, but those are the kind of things that they did. And, you know, I personally thought that was one of the best uses of the Call of Cthulhu system to demonstrate that, yeah, now you're in Rome, now you're in Sparta, now you're in, you know, wherever it is, and it's still working. You know, the mechanics still support it, and each scenario, although they, you know, they didn't have to, they knew that nowadays with our access to information through the internet, if you want to polish up your Greek, your Laconian culture for, you know, Sparta, you know, you can go and do some research and you can fill in all the blanks that the players do not have to, you know, sort of as a keeper and as a guy creating the scenario, you do not have to have every single fact marshaled and ready to go in the written publishable document. That this right, stuff can be filled in by the keeper once they get access to it and familiarize themselves with the main, you know, the main plot points. They can then enrich the experience by doing the side, you know, side research and stuff like that. Yeah. But I would recommend Strange Aeons. It's a pretty bold for me. You know, I thought the example of how, you know, what do we have in mainline Call of Cthulhu? We have Gaslight, Classic Era, Cthulhu Now, and we have Invictus, and, you know, Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. That's pretty goddamn broad, you know, a spectrum. And God knows there's what. There's fiction collections of, you know, pirate stories, Wild West stories with Cthulhu sure, in it, you know. So, and, you know, Pagan's been working on some Wild West stuff for a long time. You know, we have a big ton of Wild West scenarios that have all been play-tested and written. The one thing we've always been wrestling with is, particularly in this day and age, is how much of a source book do we really need to include? You know, do we need to include a timeline of the Wild West when so much of that stuff is available out there?
Right, right.
Through these other sources. I'm getting to the point where I think, you know, less is more. I think that we can get away without having to provide too much of a source book. I mean,
yeah, well, you know, the assumption is, okay, if you're buying a Wild West source book, we're going to assume you're interested in the era, and therefore know something about it or can find something out about it.
Yeah.
And we don't have to just disgorge our – we don't have to recreate Wikipedia for you because you can go to it yourself.
About the most important thing you'd have to do in some of these eras, if you're going to cover a multiple-year time span for a source book, is just to make sure that there's – if there's technologies that the players are going to want to access, are they going to be available at that time?
And in that place.
Yeah. We had a scenario where the tipping point of the scenario was finding a refrigerator in a house. And when it was the 1920s, and the most anyone would ever have was would be an ice box or a cool box. And we found an industrial refrigerator, and yeah, you know, we found all the shit you don't want to find in an industrial refrigerator. But, you know, seeing that piece of technology wired into the building, that was the sign that something was clearly wrong because it stood out, you know. But, yeah, I highly recommend Strange Aeons to anyone who's interested in, you know, using different eras and different backgrounds to show, you know, demonstrate that, oh, my God, it still works, you know.
All right.
All right.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that sounds really interesting about that is the possibility that, okay, here's this crazy high tech, and it's a fridge, and that's something you can get into. And this is probably less true with Cthulhu gaming, but, you know, Lovecraft was a science fiction writer.
That's great.
You can run into this stuff of, you know, oh, my God, this clock, it's accurate within 1 second. How did they even make that?
Yeah.
Or if you wanted to somehow do a 007 game in Victorian England, I mean, just like, okay, well, what's the technology that's 20 years away from here?
Yeah.
And we'll give it to you now.
Yeah, exactly. The C96 automatic pistol, the Mauser, Brumenthal Mauser, shows up 10 years before it's supposed to show up. Yeah, that's the crazy. You know, that's the crazy leap forward that confounds the players. But it doesn't look like anything to us in retrospect.
Or, you know, just magnetic navigation of ships.
Yeah. Yeah.
They must have access to dark powers if they know where they are in the middle of the ocean. They are clearly in league with the deep ones.
I think we'll find out what happened. We lost Ross
a while ago, and so I'll need to get the files to him to stitch together. But yeah, let's call it a day. I think we've got a lot of good discussion.
Covered a lot of stuff.
There's obviously a lot more honest, we can still talk about, but that's what later episodes are for.
All right. Well, great. That's fine. And I guess it's up to one of us, Shane, to say that's all from Unspeakable. Oh, wait, I just said it.